Today is Thursday, October 6th, 2011. This is Desiree Hargis, Graduate Research Assistant at the University of Texas at Austin, H.J. Lucher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports, Olympic Studies Center. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project, today I am interviewing Andy Larkin over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City.
Okay.
My name is Andrew Larkin. I was born in September 20th, 1946, in New Britain, Connecticut, and I grew up in Connecticut. I first started doing sport in boarding school. I had a roommate named Ben White who talked about going to the Olympics and said I should do cross country in the ninth grade. I had an eighth grade teacher who told me about his crew, and I remember when my father took me to Cambridge when I was in the eighth grade, I saw somebody rowing on the river in a single, and it just struck me as a wonderful thing to do. It turned out later I found out my father had briefly rowed as well as my older brother. Mm. I ran cross country. My coach was John Small, who was very inspirational. He had another brother named Bruce Small. Bruce Small, who coached at South Kent, where Peter Raymond was, who also rode in the Olympics. Bruce Small saw me once and looked around me and said that I should row six. And I decided I would go to Harvard and row six. And I thought that would be wonderful to go to the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
Without ever having rowed my first year, I was on the second freshman. In the second year, I won the seat race and got in the sixth seat in the Harvard varsity crew in 1966. I was held that seat for 3 years. In 1966, I went to the World Championships and bled Yugoslavia with Fritz Hobbs and Jake Fichter. In 1967, we had a wonderful year in which we won the gold in the Pan American Games,
mm-hmm.
and the North American Championships, and came in fourth and had our asses kicked. We came back to the North American Nationals and raced well against New Zealand. Then we earned a berth to go to the European Championships. In our first race, we were beat badly by the Germans. In our second race, we beat the Czechs and made it to the finals. And in the final of that race, we're in a race of six boats over 2,000 meters, a six-minute race. Halfway through the race, we were in last place at 6 seconds. And in the next 500 meters, we found something and went from last to second, a length behind the Germans. The Russians passed us. We passed the Germans and came in within the second and a half of the West German crew. And they had won the gold in Mexico, in Rome, and silver in Tokyo. And we had given them a race for our money. We had only one person graduating from that crew. And we thought we were hot shit. The next year, in 1968, was a much more complicated year. It was followed by the issues of war, the assassination of Martin Luther King, the assassination of Kennedy. That was the background. Creation of what was then called the Olympic Project for Human Rights, which was set up by Martin Luther King and Harry Edwards, that say that what better place to discuss the issue of human rights in the nonviolent milieu of the Olympics as a noble way of dealing with these issues. And I, as one, felt that this was a compelling argument. Within that context, we went to the 1968 trials. trial, it was a false start. Penn got the lead on us. The race was never called back. I've discussed this with John Ferris, who was in the Vesper boat just last week. Nonetheless, in a piece that was talked about by Roger Angel in the New York Times, we came from behind and beat the University of Pennsylvania to earn the right to go to the games.
Mm-hmm.
And then at that point, Paul Hoffman and Cleve Lipton, after the trials, and met with Harry Edwards. After the trials, I got this intestinal thing that left me wasted, and I was unable to. So that I missed a few days in July when most of the team returned and had a press conference with Harry Edwards that made the news. I was at home, ill. At that time, I was in, had been accepted at medical school.
Mm-hmm.
I was told that I couldn't go to both the Olympics and medical school.
Oh, my
gosh. I had to do it. I was told that if I didn't go to medical school, they would notify my draft board, and they would allow me to reapply for to get to medical school. Those are some pretty hard times for me personally.
Yeah.
I'd rather die. Serious choices. Dire choice. And that kind of, and then what happened? So I decided that I was going to go. I had one opportunity to go. I was going to basically try and do both. And so I went off to the Olympic. And then that was happening. We went to high altitude training. We had a lot of time in our hands. We wrote something called the Harvard Letter, the Harvard Crew Letter. Do you have a copy of that?
Yes, I do have a copy of that. And Mr. Larkin, can I ask you to speak up just a little bit? The
sure.
Volume's a little bit quiet on your end. But I do have a copy of that. Can you tell me some more about that?
Well, this was written by my teammates then at a time in which I was absent from the crew. Does that make sense?
Yes, yes. Your name is typed in the typewritten version on the bottom, but you were absent from the crew when they actually wrote it?
Yeah, the whole process of writing and talking about and going to see Harry is what it meant. I was not present because I developed this terrible intestinal disorder in California after the trials.
Okay.
And, but I supported it fully, you know. And I ended up writing letters saying, is the letters... I mean, I'll even quote from it. If I might, we felt that the place of the black man in American society, they had a struggle for you. They were struggling for equal human rights, and that we should support them. It seemed like
mm-hmm.
the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So we did.
Mm-hmm.
And we went off, and then we ended up finding out that the U.S. Olympic Committee was pretty offended by us writing that.
Hmm.
That we had gone to the Pan American Games, and they said the reason we should most importantly beat the Cubans was because they were communists, and we had to show that we could beat them in sport, that showing that our form of capitalism was superior to their form of communism. And so that was the tone of the U.S. being on the Olympic team, and we felt there were other voices that should be expressed, and we tried to express them. And remarkably, almost nothing happened. No one wrote us letters back, but we were sent a lot of letters, and that's all we did. And the letters, remarkably innocent by today's standards. And then we went to the games, and when we'd been successful in the European champions, we were well and fit. In Mexico, there was no oxygen. The oxygen deficit that hit the rowers most heavily of all the sports, because rowing is a combination of weightlifting and running. And at the time of the Repechaage, there were dozens of world-class crews unable to finish the race. It was a quiet, an echo slightly of all the people who had been slaughtered in the massacres in October, and weeks before the games went on, a form of tenement square and let the sweep up the blood off the streets and let the games begin was just
Can you hold on just a second, Mr. Larkin? How many letters did you send?
Me personally?
Mm-hmm. Or the team?
I think we got a list of everybody on the Olympic team, which was some 500, I think.
So you sent about 500 letters?
I think so.
Wow. Okay, that's amazing. And very little response or no response?
No response. I mean, you could ask other people involved. My understanding at the time was we'd get a list of who was on the team, and we'd send them a copy of the mimeographed letter, and then we'd send a little personal hand note. Hello, my name is, we thought you ought to know something about it. Yeah.
Wow.
So, I mean, you should ask other members of the crew. That's my recollection.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just something to do to fill your time when you're training. I think I wrote a fair number.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing I did. And then I was also in medical school, so I brought around textbooks of histology and biochemistry.
Yeah. And you were saying that Harry Edwards worked with Dr. King on the project or consulted with Dr. King?
Yes, they were the co-founders.
Mm.
Of the Olympic Project for Human Rights, Martin Luther King and Harry Edwards.
I had read about Harry Edwards previously, but I had not read very much about Dr. King's involvement, aside from Edwards being inspired by him. But thank you for providing
you
that.
You read about it in John Carlos's book that he just came out with this spring. Notes that when John Carlos was down in Harlem, he went down to the meeting and Martin Luther King was in the room, so we went home to tell his mother about it. You know, he got points because his mother adored Martin Luther King, and anything John Carlos did that had to do with Martin Luther King was, a blessing.
Mm. Is this in Silent Gesture?
Is that his latest book? Yeah, I loaned it to somebody. It came out 2010 or 11.
Okay. Thank you very much for clearing that up. I'll have to read some more about that. So you were talking about the Tlatelolco massacre?
Yes, I mean, the massacre had occurred as we were preparing to fly to Mexico. There were some people who were aware of it going on, and it was, well, what do you do now? And the this is also covered quite powerfully in movies like Fists of Freedom, which was put out a few years. So anyway, there we're going. They're massacring people. We go to the opening ceremonies, and they are releasing doves, and people are trying. The whole way is lined with troops and machine guns from the Olympic Village to the opening ceremony, and they release doves, and people break in the doors and go back to club them with pistols. We did not sit march in the opening ceremony, in part because I think people thought we were offensive in saying, talking about it. I think we were somewhat ostracized, and we didn't want to stand for hours before a race and just weaken ourselves. But we did sit in the stands, and then we got in their opening race. In our opening race, the stroke collapsed after 1,000 meters and couldn't continue. And then equipment broke, and we had been second halfway through the race and came in fifth with a boat that wasn't running. We had lost 15 pounds per person from not eating and intestinal disorders. We got into the Repishaw, and Mike Livingston, who was supposed to row in the boat, said, I can't row today. You'll have to find somebody else. And Harry Parker went up to Jake Victor and said, Jake, you better not eat much food. You're rowing today. The first time in the repertoire, the first time we rowed 40 strokes together as a crew, we're in the race, and halfway through the race, we were in last place. But the next 5,000 meters were slower than that, but we went from last place to second place and just closed on the Czechoslovakians. And we beat them by 6 seconds the year before, and we could barely keep up with them. And that was a race in the repertoire, and I got out of the boat and stood up, and my legs were shaky, and I realized that I really had given it all.
And what position? I'm sorry, what position?
I rode six.
Okay.
And six is, as we like to say, is in the boats, the people, the stroke pair, the stroke and seven, establish a rhythm. The bow pair balances the boat and holds it steady. And in the middle, you have what they call the engine room, which just adds force and power. And the six seat is where that was. We like to think an important part of the transfer of rhythm to power. That's where I wrote.
Ah.
Being the, at that time, the biggest and the tallest.
Uh-huh.
That was my seat. So there we were, and then Paul, and I was at the time in the high rises, and I was exhausted and tired from the altitude and the training and reading biochemistry. Paul was relatively free and went out to see the track and field. And I'm sure you've heard the story, but from my perspective, classically the image of Smith and Carlos, the iconic picture of the 1968 Games, is often cut and shows two black athletes, Smith and Carlos, and it cuts out Norm Peters, the Australian. Even the commemorative statue in Speed City cuts him out of the picture. But Norm, I must say, approached Smith and Carlos and said, you know, they treat the Aborigines terrible, and what can I do? And they said, well, why don't you wear a button? And Paul Hoffman then volunteered a button for the Olympic Project for Human Rights. So the picture that most is, the reality is that they're blacks and whites together wearing the same project of Olympic Project for Human Rights.
Mm-hmm.
This was witnessed by the U.S. Olympic Committee, and they went outraged, berserk. And so the day before the finals, there was a hearing to determine whether or not Paul would be eligible to row. They're going to throw him off the team because he participated in a piece of political activity contrary to the spirit of the Olympics. We didn't know, and with that, and so we weren't sure if we really wanted to row since we were being thrown off for merely what I thought was expressing an opinion in a nonviolent way about an important issue.
Mm-hmm.
An important issue is being war and race. So, and then we got to the finals, and we were in the thick of things halfway through the race, and in the last 1,000 meters, the boat hit a wall, and there was just nothing in the boat, and we came in sixth. And it was the best we could do, and we'd done better in other days, but that's what happens. On certain days, it matters what you do. That was the Olympics. That was a Saturday. The next morning, I was taken to the airport, and I flew to Boston. And Monday morning, I was at Harvard Medical School, and I missed the first 6 weeks of medical school because of a prior commitment. And I realized that if I was in East Germany, the sports psychologist would not have allowed me to do this. It was just too much to do to anybody to have so little recovery. But, well, that's what I did. And, you know, other people in 1968 died. So, you know, things were worse for others. And there shortly appeared a letter that was written by Douglas Roby, who is then president of the U.S. Olympic team. And it's a very me a very disturbing letter. Have you heard about the Douglas Roby letter?
No, I haven't.
Let me see if I can find it. This is actually worth reading, I think. Douglas Roby, president of the U.S. Olympic Committee, sends us hate mail after the games are over, in which he says that this is my scrapbook I'm going through. So afterwards we get a letter, and I'd like to quote this. This is a letter to our coach. Dear Mr. Parker, upon my return from Mexico, I noticed on my desk a meme letter signed by 8 members of your crew. Actually, he doesn't know how to count. There were only 5 or 6. I also found a number of letters which various athletes forwarded both to me and the Olympic House were in the enclosed copies of letters sent to them by members of the crew. What I have not been able to understand is why, with the selection of the Howard 8 Olympic crew to represent the United States at the Olympic Games, most of these crew members immediately expelled from their minds the purpose and objective for which they're selected and embarked on a rather strenuous program of civil rights and social justice with other members of our Olympic delegation to Mexico City. Civil rights and the promotion of social justice may have their place in various facets of society, but certainly this sort of promotion has no place in the Olympic Games, particularly when they're held in a foreign country, which our country is not particularly involved in these internal problems of ours. Doesn't make sense. After meeting with you in Mexico and having had a brief exam of your athlete, it is my feeling you are probably the one most responsible for taking the Harvard crew and possibly their minds away from the purpose, for which they took this group to Mexico City to represent the Games. At one time, I personally was in favor of disqualifying you and your crew for acts grossly unbecoming to members of our Olympic team. I'm now glad that I did not encourage such a harsh action, for I feel that the miserable performance of you and your crew will stand as a permanent record against you and the athletes which you led. As a boy, I had certain admiration and respect for Harvard and the men it produced. Certainly serious intellectual degeneration has taken place in this once great university if you and several members of your crew are examples of the type of men that are within its walls. Sincerely, Douglas Roby, President, U.S. Olympic Committee. It's hard to make this stuff up.
Definitely.
It was rather shocking to me as a young lad. And he sends a carbon copy to Nathan Pusey, president of Harvard University. And there's an apocryphal story in which President Pusey calls Harry Parker and says, "What are you going to do about this?" And Harry Parker, who would never tell anybody anything, said, "What are you going to do, Mr. President?" And Mr. Pusey said, "It's just beneath my dignity to respond to stuff like this." And Harry Parker said, It certainly agreed, and it was beneath his dignity. And I must say, Harry Parker had little to do with our actions. But this meant their point of view that, and you just have to use strong language, that here our coach was, here the Harvard Pinko liberals were stirring up the Negroes. And it was our fault. And not only that, but we had a Jewish coxswain, so they're the Jews at Harvard creating all these problems, was some of the facts of the letter. So anyway, that was 1968, and then I went off to Mexico, and I gave up rowing for a while, and then I moved back to the Valley, and I've taken up rowing again. And that's my discussion of the Harvard crew letter, the massacre, accommodations, my event. We got there are some people in the crew who supported it and some people who didn't. And by and large, they were them and we were us, and it really didn't make a whole lot of difference.
we didn't have much testing. I was moved by the Smith Carlos. I was overwhelmed that the biggest force at the games was the media. And the tone changed from having gone to world championships where the focus was the athletes themselves. It then was the media. And I was disturbed to hear that Richard Nixon was advertising supporting the Olympics, because I certainly didn't go to the Olympics to help elect Richard Nixon.
Mm.
I was the closing ceremonies and all that stuff. I wasn't there. And about amateurs, you know, I think amateur is wonderful. And it's amateur comes to Greek, to love. And amateurs do things because they love to do it. Professionals do things because they get paid. And this makes a big difference. And I'm really saddened to see that doing things for, and you know, we were coddled, I suppose, silver spoon lads whose parents supported us. And yet, you know, we didn't make any money out of it. And we did it because, you know, we were under the influence of Harry Parker, a remarkable coach who has inspired generations of people and is now coaching in his 50th year and has sent dozens and dozens of people to the Olympics. So I must say that rowing had been remarkably important for reasons that have to do with, you know, Harry Parker, who is just stunning as a coach. And a remarkable, I went and saw some of the athletes, and they said, you know, I rode with Harry in the middle of the last century, the previous millennium. And they said, and what was he like? I said, well, he never talked. They said, well, he still doesn't talk. He just looks at us and says, determination, and we don't know what to do. But they continued to be remarkably successful in the ways that are exceptional in all sport. And what do I think of rowing? Rowing is one of my great loves. In the 1880s, it was nearly a professional sport, and they saw money coming into it, and they saw that money would ruin the sport. And they said, let's keep the money out of it. And today we have the scandals in basketball and baseball where the money is just really sullied the sport for that moment in television.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in rowing, unlike all other, many other team sports, does not depend upon the photogenic moment of the hero when somebody does something brilliant or stupid. It's a wonderful lesson for life that has all the metaphors. You're in the boat together and you're all pulling your oar, and the outcome of it all is dependent upon the whole of you and not the individual. And that's a wonderful life lesson in these days of where so many people think about being stars. And then a few other thoughts. And one is that a few years ago, the U.S. Olympic team sent us out a CD to talk about the story of Jim Thorpe. Jim Thorpe, the, you know, wins the decathlon, says something cute to the king, and then is outed. It's turned out that he was too naive to not forge his signature. It was outed that he'd received some money for playing ball. And stripped of his medal, died shamed. And we're to tell the story of what a sad story this is. And I was just stunned that the U.S. Olympic Committee in 2008 wanted to tell that story, because now you can go on Wikipedia and find out that Jim Thorpe was outed by none other than Avery Brundage, disgruntled member of the decathlon team who came in 15th and was outraged that this half-breed person had beaten him and outed him, and took his hatred to become the president of the U.S. Olympic team that went to Berlin. And out of respect for his host country, he scratched two of the Jewish sprinters because it was bad enough that the
Negroes were going to beat the Germans, but to have both the Negroes and the Jews both beating the Germans was more than he could possibly do to his host country. And then he went on to get the contract to build the German embassy in the United States. And there are photographs of the Berlin Olympics in which the Nazi athletes are standing listening to their national anthem with their fists raised high in a salute that is exactly what the blacks did in 1968.
Mm.
So Avery Brundage was the person who was outraged by Smith and Carlos. He was by that time the president of the International Olympic Committee. And for all the people who think that the Olympics are not political, they in fact are deeply political. And the people who have run them have been, at least Avery Brundage, deep sympathizers for the Nazis. So that when the Olympic Project for Human Rights started, one of the issues was South Africa should not be allowed into the Olympics because of their racial tendencies. You know, it gets, and then a final thought. So we supported the Olympic Project for Human Rights, and it really didn't get very far. And it is lost to the Olympic Project for Corporate Rights. And today, the corporations rule the Olympics. And, you know, it's not about, it's about corporations and stuff like that. And another thought is that they spent $2 billion for terrorists at the Greek Games. And the history of the Olympics is, by and large, it's the host countries themselves that have been the most violent to the people. And that was pretty clear in the Mexican massacres where they slaughtered hundreds and hundreds. And yet it isn't, and yet many people regard the Munich Games as the first violent games. And yet, I guess they're the first violent games that were also televised. They didn't happen to televise the massacres are shown on the evening news. And there's a great amnesia in America about the nobody knowing that they ever occurred.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed this amnesia.
Yeah. Why do I think?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it occasionally turns up in the New York Times. There's an occasional story that they're going to do in it. In part because Mexico's never examined it, in the same way the U.S. has never examined its crimes, unlike, you know. I don't know why. It's not part of the story. You know, the story has been crafted. You know, Smith and Carlos has now been crafted as two athletes. And yet, the facts, there was three athletes.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, you know, that makes a big difference. And yet, you know, that story's not being told either.
There's a wonderful documentary called Salute that was done by Peter Norman's, I believe, his nephew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I haven't seen that.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought I'd like to take a look at that.
Mm-hmm. It's wonderful because it does tell, you know, the other half of the story that isn't often told about Peter Norman and what he did.
And, you know, my understanding of it is that, you know, he had a worse time than Smith and Carlos because Smith and Carlos had, you could go back to the hood and there is, like, nobody for Norm Peters. You know, they didn't allow him to compete in the 1972 games, whereas Paul Hoffman and Cleve Livingston, who, you know, were very instrumental in Harvard's response, you know, were allowed to compete and, you know, competed rather successfully and got a silver medal in the games.
Mm-hmm.
Other people were the core of the, you know, some people rode in both the 68 boat as well as the 72 boat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there's nobody, I don't know why people don't want to hear the story. It's a minor story, and there's this woman who came out with a book a couple of years ago. She worked for the news. Yeah, and she came to UMass to tell the story of Smith and Carlos, and she said she got up and said she talked for the whole hour and never mentioned Norm Peters. And I got up and said, you know, you've overlooked Norm Peters and he has the button and you really should have done that. And then somebody else said, was there other white support for this all? And she said, yes, the Harvard Olympic crew, at which point my hand involuntarily shot up in a salute. And she said, you'll have to wait your turn. And she said, the Harvard crew, oh, yeah, so-and-so, number the fourth. I had to hold my tongue. She was like, actually, the only person to name the fourth was Fritz Hobbs the fourth, who never supported it, and it's actually never would, never will. But she was really snotty about us, and I went up to her afterwards, and I introduced myself. And she was taken a little back. But, I mean, even people are telling the story, tell it that way. So anyway, I was one of the guys who went to the Harvard Games, the Olympic Games, and I represented Harvard for the crew. And it was deeply affected me. And I'm so glad that somebody actually cares and was willing to call me up and ask me a few questions.
Well, I'm so glad that you were willing to talk to me about it. This has been wonderful.
And that went on about 45 minutes, I think. So what are you going to do with all this stuff?
Well, first of all, I'd like to ask you just a couple more questions.
Sure, I'd be delighted.
So,
hey, listen, I got somebody who's a graduate student who has to listen to me. This is heaven.
So where did you guys do your high altitude training prior to going to Mexico City?
Gunnison, Colorado.
Okay, on the lake there?
And it was freezing. We'd like get up in the morning and there'd be ice in October at high altitude. And so we did a month there and then they flew us, you know. We plunged us into the jungle of Mexico. It was like it's a bit of a shock.
Yeah, I bet. So did you feel that your training helped you at all?
I think that it's impossible to say. If we'd gone, yes, the training was helpful. The high altitude training, it must have been helpful, you know. But it was most, of all the people, it was most burdensome upon the oarsmen collectively. Because we do heavy weightlifting sprints. And one of the girlfriends of one of the crew members said, you know, the veterinarians are not allowing the horses to compete at altitude because they're saying it's too dangerous. In point of fact, it probably was too dangerous. If you have any accounting of the repertoire of rowing, I've been on the international circuit for 2 years. People could finish the races for which they trained. This is not so at Mexico. There is a Swiss double undefeated in international competition for 3 years, could not make the finals.
Oh, my goodness.
It's just dim, but they should not. Yes, the altitude helped. But if really, they shouldn't have done it at altitude. It was unkind. They still do it, in fact, I suppose. But it's like incredibly dumb. I mean, I went on and became a pulmonary physician. You know, the oxygen level at sea level is like 155 torr. You know, it's 155. In Mexico, it's like 110. Rowing specifically is that you create the maximum tolerable anaerobic debt in 6 minutes. And that's what a 6 minute race is. It's that conditioning of going anaerobic for most of the event. And then what they did is they turned off the oxygen.
And yes, they race there, but it's bad. It's very. I would caution people against racing at altitude. You know, rowing should be done at sea level.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, yes, the altitude, the training helped. The crew fell apart at altitude. We never had this. People were getting intestinal things and fatigued and burnt out, and it was the whole thing was just very. Just, you know, it's distressing because we couldn't hold it together.
Mm-hmm.
And then and the people who did what best were the, and we lost weight. And so such are the kinds of people who lose of why they lose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we played with the big kids and were really good one year. We played with the big kids and got our ass kicked the next year. But such is the nature of life.
Yeah. How do you think the teams that got the gold medals, how do you think they were able to do it?
Well, in track and field, you never have to, I don't, in sprint, you know, they breathe some, but, you know, Bob Beamon jumped well because there's no oxygen to slow him down.
Right. Yeah.
There's less air resistance.
What about
you don't have to be any good, you just have to beat everybody else.
Right.
They're going to hand out the medals. But people did set records, but mostly there's some they could. Short events and track and field. Boom. I don't think they set a record in the marathon, but you could correct me.
I don't think so. The endurance events had a really hard time. So I imagine that the rowing events probably, the times there were less than what they had been previously, correct?
Yeah. I mean, the conditions, we won the Olympic trials in 5 minutes and 40 seconds with a tailwind. And the West Germans won the Olympics in a time of 6:06 and we were 6:14.
Mm.
You know, the times were just, they were just really slow. Because it's an endurance sport, oh, that's not very long.
Yeah. So, West Germany got the gold in.
West Germany got the gold. We could come within a second of half of them. And I think Australia, or I have the results here. See, where were they? I may not. Yes, I think in Australia and Russia and New Zealand and Czechoslovakia and us, I think.
Okay.
All within 6 or 7 seconds.
Wow. That's really close.
It was actually pretty close for coming. Yes. And we are written up in Newsweek as being Harvard hippies.
Because of your hair?
Because of our hair, yeah. We had hair, and some of us had beards. So they decided we were hippies.
I did read one of those articles, and I remember reading about the descriptions, how they were describing you, and that's why they were calling you hippies. How did you guys feel about that?
Well, what the hell? Why not? Hippies seem to be having fun. I had a pink tie. You know, I thought the big issue is that there were race and war. You know, if the Olympic Project for Human Rights had issued, organized around issues of war, I would have signed up for that, too.
Yeah.
You know, the other interesting story is our coaches, Howard had this event, Harvard and the Olympics. And our coach, Harry Parker, got up and to say the reason he ended up coaching at Harvard was because of Sputnik. He was off on a destroyer. Sputnik was launched a week later. They decided they were going to fund sport. So anybody who wanted to go to the Olympics, just sign up. And so he called his old coach and said, should I go to the, he said, sure. So he went off to the Navy, took his Navy appointment, took it to the Navy Yard and said, I'll be available from 10 in the morning to 3 in the afternoon. Admiral and Harry represented the U.S. In the Roman Olympics. And they went to
I think he then continued rowing and actually went to, I think, to
Tokyo?
No, he was, no, he went to where they row in England. I'm blocking Henley. He went to Henley and met the Harvard people, and they said, why don't you come back and be our freshman coach? And he agreed to be a freshman coach. And then the coach died. And Harry went up to the athletic director and said, well, you're going to need a head coach. And the coach said, well, I think you'll just do fine. And there was Harry, the head coach in 1963 at the age of 31 or something.
Wow.
A remarkable person. And he's still coaching today.
Is he still at Harvard?
For real. He's still a Harvard heavyweight crew coach. Last year they had a building year, and they had seven juniors, and they came in second in the nation. The most striking difference was they had two Americans on the Harvard varsity crew. The rest were members of the British Commonwealth. They lost to a crew from Washington that had gone further and gotten people from East Germany and Slovak in their boat, and it beaten them. But he's still the coach. I mean, this is, to my mind, also unbelievable.
Wow. That is amazing. It would be wonderful to talk to him.
He's on your list of people who are on the team there.
Mm-hmm. Well, then I think we're going to have to seriously get in contact with him then.
Yeah, you should. So that's my story. I think, and I'd be happy if you reflected and wanted to call me back and talk some more.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely will probably think of some more questions to ask you. I'm thinking of a couple more right now, but do you have time or do you need to go?
Sure, I don't have anything. I have to drop my car off at 1 o'clock.
Okay.
I can give you another hour.
Okay. So going back to the medal winners, the East Germans and the Soviets.
The West Germans.
Oh, sorry, the West Germans and the Soviets. Did you interact with them or talk with them at any time?
You know, mostly, most of that interaction goes on after the races.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were there. Harry said, you are here to row. You are not here to have fun. You are not here to fraternize. You have only one job. You know, so we had interacted with him a little in Europe, but we had not interacted with him because that wasn't the time.
Right. Yeah.
And then the time was when I was in medical school. It was a hard year on me. It was like one of those, you know, those stressful, you could count up your stress scores, moving, the Olympics, medical school 6 weeks late. You know, it was like a lot.
Yeah,
so I didn't interact with him.
Yeah, it sounds like a very stressful time for you.
It was, frankly. But my cohort, you know, my God, thousands of slaughtered, thousands have come back with PTSD. You know?
Yeah, from the Vietnam War.
Yeah, those are hard times.
Definitely.
Everybody got kicked. So then, what are the? Do you have a list of people from the Harvard crew? Are you planning to interview 500 people?
We hope to get to around 300. That's our hope, and we do have Paul Hoffman and Cleve Livingston.
Cleve Livingston. You should also have Scott Beckett and Kurt Canning.
We don't, for some reason, I don't know if we just haven't, they haven't made it to the list yet for some reason, or if we haven't been able to find their contact information.
I have contact information.
Oh, well, if you...
Do you have contact information for the Harvard crew?
That would be wonderful. We'll talk about that in just a second, if I can get that from you at the end here.
Sure.
But how did... people, the other Olympians, treat you at the Olympic Village?
Me personally, I'm pretty shy. You know, I sat down with George Foreman one day for lunch. He didn't have anything to say to me, but so I've read, you know, he wasn't very talkative in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are members of a team, we by and large, you know, there was some opportunity for interacting. To my thinking, I was studying for medical school. I was sleeping. I was training.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have that much extra time.
Right. Did the other athletes approach you after the Smith and Carlos salute?
No.
What about
But you'll have to speak to the other members. I mean, it was the strangest thing. I wrote like dozens and dozens. It may have been 100 letters, for God's sakes. I don't know. And I heard nothing about it from anybody. And no one spoke to me. I'm shy, so maybe, how much is this me? But there was, I never had a dialogue other than with my group members. And by and large, they said, we talked about it when we wrote the letter, you know. And to some extent, I feel like I missed the whole thing.
Hmm.
You know what I'm saying? I wasn't threatened. You know, there wasn't a lot of, I didn't fraternize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So many of the athletes that we've interviewed felt, you know, very strongly about the salute and the Olympic Project for Human Rights, that it was not appropriate because the Olympic Games is not a place to air internal political grievances. Why do you think that they feel so strongly that in that way?
These are polarizing times. Why do they feel that it was wrong? Because I suppose that there's different ways of approaching things and saying that they have a different approach to it. I think I felt it was, if I was asked a question, I should speak out. I think other people feel that that's inappropriate. I think that people have always felt that there's always been this notion that politics is separate from athletics, that athletics somehow transcends all of this. And what we did was distasteful. It was airing dirty laundry.
No problem.
And there's that notion, and that, you know, that we don't talk about the disgraces. We don't talk about, you know, everybody loves the story of Jesse Owens, but after the games, Jesse Owens, to my understanding, had it and he wanted to go home. He wanted to rest. He was burnt out, and his handler said, no, we want to watch you race some more. It's entertaining watching you. And he said, no, I'm going home. And they said, if you go home, we're going to strip you of your amateur status. And I believe they did, and he was reduced to racing and fares for pocket change. And somehow we don't want to tell these stories. I think that politics has always been in the Olympics.
You make a good point that it is very political, so it's interesting how political it is, yet people at the same time deny the politics.
It's not happening. We can do it without the politics. It doesn't matter at all. And I'm fine with that, except it was so deeply ingrained, the fascism of the U.S. Olympic Committee, that you had to say, wait a minute, those aren't my values. And I suppose whether people agreed with the airing of dirty laundry or not may in part reflect of what their values were.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying it's like peace and justice, man. So that makes me like a Harvard hippie. And they're saying, no, it's, you know, winning. I mean, I don't know what they say. I guess it offended a lot of people, but, you know, so did the anti-war movement offend a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Martin Luther King offended enough people to get himself killed.
Yeah.
You know,
And it was part of the Cold War. That's the reason it got funded. And then when the Cold War sort of ran out, they ran out of funding. They got the corporations to run it. You know, I think whatever, you know, you certainly wouldn't have anything like this happening today where people are talking about peace and justice. You know, what it's been purged.
And from the Olympic Games or from society in general?
Well, largely from the Olympic Games.
Mm-hmm.
A lot from society. The sports figures, you know, they're going to have the Major League Baseball in Arizona, which has this, would deport half of the baseball teams, members of the baseball team, back to the Dominican Republic, and yet we're going to go there. This offends people.
Definitely.
So I don't know. So who did we offend? We defended people who thought that, well, I don't, you'd have to ask them why. And whether this, and my guess is dirty laundry, perhaps, but supposing it had gone differently, supposing people said, yes, we're all in this together, we're all one. You know, it might have, you know, never happened, but some people tried. I guess we are a little minority. I think it's like only, two dozen people who thought that what Smith and Carlos did on the Olympic team, maybe more, I don't know how many people liked it.
Mm-hmm.
It was controversial.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Definitely. So when did you get to Mexico City? How many days or weeks before the actual games did you arrive in Mexico City?
I think we arrived probably a week before, after the massacres, maybe for a week.
And did you meet anyone or speak with anyone there in Mexico City who told you anything about the massacres and what really happened?
No. I mean, we're just kids playing games, you know? No, I didn't speak to anybody. We heard about it. I mean, I must have spoken to somebody to find out about it, but I'm not quite sure what.
Mm. Okay. Well, unless you have any...
I mean, it's remarkably silent, the whole thing, for me.
I agree. I'm quite shocked at how many people have not heard about it or had not even heard very much about it before arriving in Mexico City at that time.
Yeah. It was outrageous, you know, but then things are... Yeah. So anyway, those are some of my thoughts, and I'd love to talk to you some more and have some more questions.
Yeah, definitely. Well, do you have anything else that you want to share with us? Any of your memories or reflections of your time in Mexico City that stand out?
You know, this is pretty much what it was. I rode. I went there and I rode, and we were burnt out and beaten up, and it was not the success we'd had the year before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah. The games are political. And they approach, you know, we were, you know, it's the medal count. It's all about the U.S. is better than Russia because we get gold medals.
And how do you think the Cold War and the Olympic Project for Human Rights were connected?
The Olympic Project for Human Rights was a brief, brief thing that lasted 6 months or a year.
Mm-hmm.
It was to say human rights were important. And I think by and large, human rights are not that important these days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've given up habeas corpus. We're spying on each other. What's happening with Homeland Security would put Stasi to shame. What else could I... The corporations have won. I'm just talking about the funding of the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
There was the tradition of whatever. The noblesse, rich people gave money so that poor people could go and, you know, play games. And it was run by philanthropy. And it turns out, you know, there's this other myth that hold the Olympics and you'll make money. You know, and it consistently costs the home country billions of debt, you know, and nobody gets the jobs. I mean, there's a lot of myths about the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm getting a little discombobulated here.
No, that's okay. I was just asking the question that led into that. In what way do you think the Cold War and the effects of the Cold War on the Games affected the reaction that the International Olympic Committee had to the Olympic Project for Human Rights?
The end of the Cold War. I think they were confusing, and as I understand the question, we're confusing eras. You know, the Cold War, the end Cold War ends with Reagan. You know, the Olympics by 1980. So we have the 68, you know, a grand Olympics. 72, spoiled by the massacre. 76, Montreal, maybe we can get this thing going. Carter, I deeply respect Jimmy Carter, but to boycott the Olympics, you know, I sort of miss the fascists in 1980 who would say, let's go to Moscow and show that our way of life is better there and beat the commies. Instead, we can't even race against the commies because they've invaded Afghanistan. It was a real blow.
Mm-hmm.
So that the 80 games, half the people didn't come, and it was absolutely no. Yes, the boycott in 1980, and suddenly we don't have the games. I must say, the Olympic Project for Human Rights did talk about a boycott, but some didn't go. Lew Alcindor didn't go. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, other people said, I'm not going. Other people said, well, we should go. In 1980, we can't go.
Mm-hmm.
And even, you know, that takes some of the wind out of it all. And then, so Soviets reciprocate in 1984. You have bad security. Of course, this is nursery school diplomacy. Well, I'm not going to play with you. Well, then I'm not going to play with you. And so that it limps along.
Yeah.
But the corporations are running it. But, you know, here we have China. I don't know how much China spent on security for the Olympics and stuff like that. No, do they know how a billion people displaced and run off their homes?
Yeah.
The Olympics have a cost.
Yeah, there's definitely a cost associated with them. So some of the black athletes on the 68 team, I understand, were approached about showing their support for the project, but declined to.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts about that or experiences related to that?
Not really. You know, George Foreman, I had lunch with him, and he didn't say a thing. He says at that time he was really pretty frightened and didn't. He was, you know, a lot of people were bewildered. And it was political. It was leftist. It was hopeful. It was optimistic. It was, you know, how many people would have supported. You know, the other question is how many people support the Olympic Project for Human Rights? And you say, oh, it's dirty laundry. Yes, the question, if Martin Luther King asked you for your help, how many of you said, what can I do? And I think you'd find, you know, it's only about 5% of the people who want to say, what can I do to Martin Luther King?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the same question just posed, whether, you know, I was, if you asked all those people, how many would want to help Martin Luther King? He's a pacifist, you know, a Christian, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Turn the other cheek, look for the best, you know, and you can, yeah, I have the dreams. You know, maybe I was infected by I Have a Dream speech and reading, you know, and I read the notes from Birmingham Jail when I was in I found them in New Haven in a bookstore and read them. You know, there was just an interest.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot of people probably shared that interest.
Yeah, that might be. Well, I'm
good. And among the blacks thought he was, you know, problem. You know, black. I mean, it's like people. Everybody thinks you're problematic or not. You just got to decide who you're going to be a problem for.
Right. That's a good way to put it. Well, Mr. Larkin, I'm going to go ahead and wrap up the call unless you have any final thoughts.
No. You want to take some emails?
Yes, definitely. Hold on just a second. I'm going to stop the recorder and then we'll talk a little bit more.
Okay, all right.